Welcome to Northwest Tech Show. I'm Dave Duncan. I'm joined today by Nate Darnell.
Hi, Dave.
Hey, thanks for joining us again today, sir.
I'd love to be here.
We are. We have plopped ourselves straight into the middle of unknown territory here, Nate. It is Pledge Week, the initial Pledge Week, Pledge Week Zero, the one from which all other Pledge Weeks will spring. This is a community radio station, and this is what we need to do to survive, so go ahead and hit him up with this first section there.
Do you listen to KMUZ on your way to and from work every day? Listening to KMUZ Community Radio is like having a vast, portable music library and a handful of friendly hosts encouraging you as you go about your day. If the music and people on KMUZ make up the soundtrack to your life, we would truly appreciate a call from you. 503-990-6101. Listener support is our most important source of income. Help keep KMUZ Community Radio listener-powered. Call 503-990-6101. And Dave.
Yes?
Dave, with that said, after my radio voice, tell the wonderful listeners, after they make a donation, what they can acquire.
Well, the first thing, and this isn't on the sheet, I'm going off script right away here, Nate. The first thing you're going to get is continued community radio. No kidding around. This is a pretty magic thing that we've got here going at all. So the first thing you're going to get is we get to stay on the air and maybe get your voice on the air, get the people that you want to hear on the air.
Weren't we recently voted like a gold standard in the community?
Yeah. Statesman Journal had a best in the Mid-Willamette Valley contest, and we got the gold placement for best radio station, which, I don't think that's anything we need to rest on our laurels for. I think that's another sign of the enthusiasm people have for the station and what it is becoming so quickly.
Exactly. We've been on the air, what, 3-4 months?
Yeah. Just in December, we first went live with the transmitter.
And we're already a top achiever?
Yeah. We're pretty. we won the little crown. So now we're going to see if we can earn that. So now, first of all, of course, we want you to have a bumper sticker, and that's kind of fun. Just the fact that we have a community radio station at all is kind of neat. And anyone who is donating to us, I'm sure that, they're going to be interested in celebrating that as well. So we do have bumper stickers now, a real staple of any sort of radio station presence. So that is... that's the first part of our pledge drive. And we don't want to make it all about just collecting money day in, day out. We're going to, try to give you some good radio here. So, hold us accountable to it. And give us a call again at the, do you have the number there?
I do indeed. It's 503-990-6101.
Now, don't be confused if I actually answer the phone on that because
we have our new teleporter in place.
Well, this was actually the side effect of that cloning experiment we covered earlier in our first show. And, it didn't go 100% according to plan, but Dave clone 30 actually is good enough to answer phones and take pledge donations. So, give 30 a good sense of, value, like he's contributing to, and, call it a pledge. So thank you. We're going to get on with the show now. Throughout this week, we're really going to be trying extra hard to put our best foot forward and, help us do that. Let us know you're out there and you're appreciating what we say because we're doing it for you. So, give us a call and let us know that you support us. So, all right. This is, as I think we've mentioned in passing, a tech show. And the thing that has really kind of caught my attention this last week is I've seen a lot of interesting material pop up about the cloud again. We have the cloud, I guess, to catch some people up, is, because a lot of times it's just thrown around as a buzzword and it's not really explained at all. So here it is. The cloud is just computing that isn't on your premises. It's almost like the return of the mainframe. A long time ago, computers first started, you know, you had the big expensive computers.
In the golden age of computers.
I keep wanting to do a movie promo or something. It's like, in a world without computers, there was the UNIVAC. Yeah, so computing was large, expensive, needed a lot of expertise to run. And so you just had the one big computer there with the true believers attending to it, and everyone else had to interact with it through first through punch cards and then through beautifully green-lit phosphor teletypes eventually. And then it moved on beyond that, like, wow, we can have a computer on our desktop. And everyone went nuts because this was the greatest thing since sliced bread. Well, there are a few things that centralized priesthood of the computer operators is good at, things like backup, which like almost no one does properly. Updating things, which almost no one does properly. So cloud computing is really about sort of the revelation that, you know, maybe we don't want everything on our desktop. Maybe there are some things that we would rather be elsewhere, that, you know, stuff that is important enough to us that we need to have high reliability. We need to have it backed up. We need to have the updates delivered automatically, essentially, because nothing is delivered. It's just the service itself updates. And someone is watching it 24 hours a day. And that's not happening on the local computer. So that is really, in a nutshell, what cloud computing is about. And the way that works with your personal computers, and again, we're kind of having a fallback in what our local processing power necessarily is, because we've got, you know, our iPads and smartphones and all this stuff. We don't necessarily have all the computing power that we did a couple of years ago at the place we're actually using it, because the place we're actually using it is anywhere we are. So in a way, anyone who's been using Google Mail has been using cloud computing, because that was, you know, all the mail client stuff is being delivered through your web browser every time you load up the page.
Wasn't Hotmail and Yahoo Mail, did that predate Google Mail?
Oh, absolutely. And I guess the reason I sort of gravitate to Google as an example for this is because they have branched out into so many different areas. You know, they're doing calendar, they're doing
documents.
Yeah, you know, spreadsheets. I also wanted to talk a little bit about Google Drive, which they just launched recently into the, there's a lot of online storage space. The one that was really popular, well, still is Dropbox. It's been integrated into a lot of iPhone apps and smartphone apps in general as kind of solving the storage component of, you know, I have something that I want to work on my desktop computer, but I also want to be able to access it on my phone, or I want to be able to share it with other people. You know, and it turned out Dropbox, they kind of fit into that niche as a very, it does the things that most people want to do the most often with the least amount of effort. It doesn't have any, it's fairly minimal on setting up permissions for things.
How cross-platform compatible is Dropbox?
Well, it's on smartphones, Macs, Windows. I believe they're still working on one for Linux.
Okay.
But it was a fairly good technology. They watch files, and when they change, they figure out what part of the file changed. It doesn't like to say, oh, the file's changed, so I'm going to re-upload the whole file. Mm-hmm. It breaks it down into certain sized blocks. It does as we've mentioned before, what a hash is. And that's a fixed length field that is derived from an arbitrarily large amount of data. And I'm trying to remember what the analogy here would be.
So is it smart enough just to detect those things that have changed and then only update those incrementally instead of backing up the entire slew of stuff?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's and it also applies the same sort of firewall piercing technologies that Skype kind of made dead simple. So you're not having to worry about how to configure your your router in order for this to work. You just, right. you know, you install it, you put in your username and password, and it works. Anyway, I didn't want to go too much off onto Dropbox, but that's just sort of an example of what has been dominating the space. And since then, a slew of other places have come out. Spider Oak, Woola, something. There was a funky solution, I think it was called Woola, where it was trying to isolate just the software component without the service. So it was essentially how to use somebody else's house as the cloud for your backups and doing all this. And likewise, you would share your space with them. You would set aside a certain amount of your hard drive that would be, you know, essentially the cloud for somebody else.
So this was agreed upon. Essentially, you're leasing real estate on your computer for somebody else to use.
Yeah. And instead of trading your eyeballs looking at advertisements for services, you're trading some of your space for service for space on someone else's machine. And you both get the benefit of having networked storage that is off-site. So if your computer crashes, you've still got it.
So what happens when your data carrier bills you by the amount of information that you move?
You don't want to, with this kind of thing, you do not want to be on a plan like that.
So you want unlimited?
Yeah, you want unlimited. And I don't know. That's a good point because the plans that tend to be based around limits are generally portable plans now. Are there still some broadbands that have?
Well, it's
pay by the megabyte.
I don't think, you know, from what I've watched in the media, they tend to ride this roller coaster between offering unlimited to gain a larger client base, and then they expand beyond what the infrastructure can handle, and everybody's using their mobile phones as wireless access points. They're moving lots of data. Then they're getting overloaded. So then they start charging more, or they start changing plan coverages again, and then they start billing by the bit. You know, and it's just this constant oscillation up and down. They're always changing things. So I don't know what's the current.
That's true. And that's a good point to pull out. One of my personal pet peeves, which was when that happens, they want to call anyone who is actually doing the more advanced uses of the net. They want to call them bandwidth hogs, right? Because they're not just checking their email. They're watching YouTube videos or curses Netflix or something.
Right.
And to put that a little step farther into things that still sort of suffers that bias, doing peer-to-peer file sharing. Now, just you invoke that name and everyone's instantly like, oh, that's dodgy stuff. And it's not really. It's a technology that's about moving large files. Yeah. And because it happens to be the files that are large and hard to move right now are movie files, they assume that's what it is. But it's just an expansion of this ongoing need for higher storage for
that may be one aspect of why it's dodgy, but I think another aspect of why it's dodgy is that from what's been shared in the media and the belief, whether or not it's true or not, is that a lot of the information which is moving is copyrighted information, and they're exceeding the copyright parameters, and that's the concern with peer-to-peer. You know, whereas it's possible that a good portion of it is freeware. But it's hard to verify and validate. And as we've improved technology, it's easier. You know, us Generation Xers, we used to have things like cassette tapes in the cars that were all magnetic. You know, and the more you play the tape, the more hiss you got on it because the tape actually, ran across a magnetic head.
Right, wore out.
You know, but generally people weren't incarcerated for, copying tapes and playing, Pearl Jam, 100 million times in their car.
As much as they should have been.
Well, the reality is that, still we when we were kids, we copied tapes and, gave a couple of copies to our friends, but we weren't really pirating the tapes and then charging people to buy it from us.
Yeah. What do you think the average high schooler's budget for buying lots of new albums is?
Yeah, I don't think it is. But I think that the real difference is that the technology that exists today allows the magnification of what we were doing, a million times over. I mean, we weren't duplicating a million tapes and sharing it. We didn't have a million friends. I wouldn't want a million. That's too much maintenance.
And that is exactly the panic button that was pressed over at the recording industry and that the movie industry is they're going, whoa, the technology is pushing up against that point at which it's easy to share our stuff. Again, though, I would say that's just an example of how strongly they have created this impression of equivalence between technology for doing bandwidth and a criminal act. Really, there is, as time progresses, if you just said, you know, we're outlawing people because they have too much bandwidth, people would say, what the heck are you smoking? But that's really what all peer-to-peer is. It's exactly the same statement saying you're against peer-to-peer because it's being used for these criminal acts. It's exactly the same thing as saying I'm against having faster bandwidth because it leads to criminal acts. And, you know, this attitude would not have got us to the point where we are right now if we'd embraced that earlier, if they'd gotten that message out so successfully sooner. We wouldn't have Skype. We wouldn't have YouTube. We wouldn't have Netflix, because the bandwidth for those things wouldn't exist. It'd be considered illegal.
And I think, too, I mean, we didn't have a lot of money when we were kids, though, and we still found ways to, you know, obtain records and, in many cases, buy records. That's why there used to be record stores, and they made a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. Used records.
I think it boils down to what we teach our kids and society to do, you know, and I think many people do the right thing. I think there's a small number of people that don't. And unfortunately, when they do the wrong thing, they do it on a very grand scale. And then reality gets kind of distorted. And then people believe that everybody behaves that way. And that's not really true.
Yeah, there is a strong tendency, right, for anything that you're doing to have sort of a bias based on, okay, what I'm doing is normal. But it still doesn't address that. I think the industries that are complaining really have to take some responsibility for setting this up, because yes, as you were saying, you listen to a tape over and over, you know, and it wears out and you buy another tape and they're like, yay, you know, that's what they want. They want it to happen.
Right.
The fact that something is almost no cost per unit to sell it and that it reproduces perfectly, that really is a signal from the market that the price on this needs to go down, and they wanted to keep it at exactly the same rate as it was when it was vinyl.
Right. But there's also a production cost, right? And, you know, for instance, let's take the example of somebody who writes a book. Mm-hmm. You know, say they write a book and, you know, it normally, under normal circumstances, they would get a royalty from every book that was sold. Well, if that book was digitized and then disseminated to a whole bunch of people, whether or not it was legal or not, and then copied and everybody else could copy it in PDF format and read it whenever they wanted to. Now, the person that took that whole 2 years of their life to write that book and really dedicated a tremendous amount of effort and energy to doing it may not be earning as much as they could. Now, they may still make a lot of money based on, you know, the Kindle or the Nook or whatever they may have that on.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, and how do you handle that? I mean, I honestly don't know. You know, I would like to believe that people who obtain that copyrighted material inappropriately would turn right around and make a donation or a commitment to purchase to the original author. But I don't know that really happens.
Okay. So this is the moral right to make money kind of argument. And I disagree that the premise that if something is difficult to do, you need to be paid for it. If I start shoving that boulder up the hill and then I'm looking around with my hand out, no one hands me anything, and it's because I wasn't supplying the market with what it wanted. The sort of the premise underneath this that many people have said, this is not by any means, you know, I'm not saying you're out on a stick or anything. The premise that underlies this is that artists will not create unless they are paid princely amounts. And anyone who has listened to local music from someone who's unpaid and they're really, really good knows that's not the case. You cannot stop a good artist from producing.
Right.
And one of the things that all the money was good for was promoting them so that more people could experience their music or their books or whatever. And again, as the cost of distribution goes to near zero, you don't need that anymore. I knew several artists that got very well known through equipment that they just had in their bedroom. They didn't need a $1 million studio anymore. Now, a book is always going to properly do, and we were getting really good into libraries last week.
Yeah.
And how nice it is to have a form of media where someone has put a lot of time into it, and that is a really great social value, and that should be protected to the extent is necessary for people to keep producing good books. That's not everyone. That's not all the time. It would be my position on that. So, and I think constitutionally this was actually written fairly well, where it said, for the promotion of the arts and sciences, Congress may, for a limited time, give a monopoly on these, you know, on books or intellectual property. This is what everything sprung from. In order to promote the arts and sciences is the key part there. So every time I see the industries trying to kind of Aikido this backwards into how can we stop progress, I'm like, well, that should be, you know, the first question should be, well, are you promoting the arts and sciences with how you're trying to pervert this copyright law? If you're not, then why should we even listen to anything more? Because that's the value we were trying to promote, was promotion of the arts and sciences back when generating an idea and a book or whatever was a really super high yield thing that only a few people could do, and reproducing it was relatively cheap. And now both parts are a lot cheaper. So, sir, thank you for this. I love that. I was starting off on cloud, but we kind of U-turned.
Well,
into
you
that.
Know what? We can turn right back around and go back to the cloud, because I've got some really important things I want to talk about with regard to the cloud. But okay. As we talked about promoting and making sure that artists are recognized, is it time to do another mention
it
of
is.
Our fundraising?
Yeah. So with this, yeah, we need to return to this. We are in Pledge Week, so Nate, hit him with the two of our 1-2 punch.
You know, Duncan, for many folks in the Willamette Valley, KMUZ is the only source for local radio, the only source for local programming produced by local voices for a wide variety of music, for the local arts and information, and often refreshing or challenging point of view, as we've just been exchanging.
Demonstrated here.
Community radio is brought to you by on-air hosts from the towns we live in. We are homegrown and handcrafted. With your help, we'll continue to bring you the programming you love to offer new sounds for your consideration and to be the voice of your community. Call now with a pledge of support for local radio. 503-990-6101. Again, that's 503-990-6101. And Duncan, can you tell them what the individuals making donations will be able to receive?
Well, as we said before, if you make that call to 503-990-6101 and talk to my clone, Duncan 30, the first thing you'll get for any amount is a bumper sticker. But if you make that amount 40 or more, you'll get another of the great staples in community support rewards, and that is the coffee cup. You know, this is a reminder every day that we actually have a local radio station with local content now. It's not just being mass manufactured in some distant city and pumped out to everywhere in the nation. Now, wouldn't your coffee be so much better in a cup that is
lavishly crafted?
I think it would be. I want to pay $40 now just to get that cup. But the thing is, the primary thing you're getting is community radio. So, you know, I appreciate your support for letting me come in and kind of share my thoughts and be able to get the sort of reactions like I'm getting from Nate and from others. That really is stimulating. It's too easy to go off in your own bubble and not have any of your thoughts challenged, and you don't learn and grow that way. So that is part of what you're getting for having a radio station at all. Radio stations are relatively cheap, but they're not free, and everything here is being done by volunteers. And the equipment, though, we need to pay rent, and we need to pay for a tower, we need to pay for power for the tower. So, please, again, one more time, that number is 503-990-6101. So I hope you'll call in with a donation and keep us on the air. All right. So you were going
to... So back to the cloud.
Segway. Hit me with a segue, man.
Okay. So, right. We could debate for hours or even days. The industry's been debating for years on, how to handle copyright and digital information and all that stuff. And, there's so many different aspects to it. It's work in progress. Something that I find interesting about the cloud is, as you explained when we started the program, for those of us that have been around in the wee beginning of the internet age.
Yeah.
It really used to be that all of the processing and all of the storage was kept on a big mainframe, in some other state or some building outside of your home. And basically, you had a little terminal that was basically the keyboard and the display. And all the big processing and stuff was done far away or even on a university campus.
And the connection was really slow. So that also limited what... And that was part of the move, was your connection's really slow, so you couldn't use all that power.
Sure, sure. And, some of the arguments to go... In reality, the cloud, while there may be a couple of things that are a little bit different, still there's the concept that most of the processing and storage is being done remotely, and you're just receiving kind of the display and the basic computer input, at your end, as opposed to having a whole personal computer on your desk that's capable of doing computer-aided drafting and word processing and accounting
and walking your dog
and toasting your toast, or toasting your dog and walking your toaster or whatever, which is what they've all been designed to do, masters of all minor things. And do we ever really use them for everything they're capable of doing? No, we only use them for generally a small number of things. And so one of the fundamental problems, though, many years ago with the mainframe system was that oftentimes the modems would go down, or the telephone line, which they were communicating over, would go down. And when that happened, everybody lost access, or on that node, lost access to connect to the computer. So that's why they stepped away from that concept and put more of the computing power at the point of use.
There was that concept of single point of failure, and that had a whole bunch of them. It was every communication link plus anything happening to that one big pile of computing.
That's right. That's right. So when that went down, now you lost your ability to use your computer. So they stepped away from that a little bit and still kept those in place. But then they started bringing in what we now consider the microcomputer, which is the first IBM XT or PC which was 20 plus years ago, and has now turned into the personal computer and now even the little tablet PCs that we're using today.
And it also marked the switch from batch computing to interactive computing to a large degree.
Right. So, as we're looking at the cloud computing environment now, that same philosophy still applies. And that's what oftentimes people don't talk about. The concept of storing all of our stuff out on a server somewhere where we can, access the information or run applications from afar only works so long as that broadband connection that we're connected to actually works.
Yeah.
Right. And if that broadband connection goes down, well, now you can't use your computer or your tablet or whatever, you are using to communicate with that service from afar. Now, what's the likelihood of that happening? Well, I think we've been pretty consistent with keeping it working, but there's always the risk. But there's always the risk that it's going to break or not work. And based on my experience in working with computers, computers aren't logical. They're vindictive. Okay. And they will always find a way to crap out at the worst possible
moment. The deadline is getting close.
That's exactly right. The moment, like the day your taxes are due, and just about the time you're about to hit that last button on, whatever tax program you're using, something is going to go haywire. That's just the nature of the beast.
If you're doing it in that case, where you're synchronized with a whole bunch of other people, and a lot of people converge on one resource at the same time, kaboom.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the drawbacks that we really have to look at. And that's why picking one technology over the other, in my experience, isn't really the best route. It's keeping a mix. So, for instance, if your Dropbox account isn't working for whatever reason, or your online storage, whatever company you're using for your online storage goes down, you still have a repository somewhere that you can go back to that's local, either on your personal computer or in your back library somewhere, where if there really is critical data, you can still get access to it.
Well, and Dropbox and its clones are in that sort of niche, because what they're doing is the full file stays on your computer, but a duplicate of it is in the cloud.
Okay.
And so what you lose is your ability to share and automatically synchronize between your computers, but you don't lose the data. So, and if you're in read-only mode, then it's exactly the same.
Right.
If you're making changes when the cloud comes back up, it should do the right thing and figure out which thing was updated most recently.
Sure. Now, I do have a question, though, too, and this brings me to the next topic, is regarding security.
That is the big problem right now that we're running into, because we kind of went through the, okay, we made it work, and now it's starting to get popular, and everyone's running to it, and now it's like, oh, wait a minute, is this at all secure? And Dropbox, to hit on them on the bad as well as the good, they were one of the really spectacular flameouts in this particular area. There was a time gap during which you could log into any account with any password.
Wow.
So it wasn't a long period of time, but it was one of these, you know, foobar, someone threw the wrong bit, yeah, and it wasn't actually checking the password.
That's a pretty significant security breach.
Yeah, yeah. Everyone's security simultaneously breached. And it was arguable about how much that actually got taken issue with. But I think it was someone on the outside that reported it. But now the other issue with it, especially I have oft on the show kind of lamented how all sense of due process and privacy seems to have been on a really rapid downslide in the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. There's been a large grab on the part of government and corporations to take data that sort of by our history and our ethical, our personal individual ethical sensibility seems pretty wrong, where they will just take or delete data without consulting the person whose data it is, and a lot of times without any due process at all. So now you also have to worry about, okay, what country is my cloud service hosted in, and do they just hand over data without a warrant or with a warrant? And so ideally, the way these things are, it's well within our ability to design these things so that the hosting company for just these storage features doesn't need to actually be able to read the data. And that was a concept that when I was listening to a recent Security Now episode, and you can find those at twit.tv. Look for Security Now show, and you'll see the last two had really good analysis of cloud computing. And also at grc.com in their Security Now section, they actually have transcripts of it, so you can just kind of read over it or search through there or something real quick and find whatever service it is you're interested in, and you know, how did they stack up in the security analysis that they were doing. But one of the things, the concepts that they, the one of the yardsticks they use in that on for any sort of service that is running over the internet is, does it adhere to PI, pre-internet encryption? Is the data being made secure at your computer that you control before it gets sent anywhere else? Because for most cases, why not do it that way? And the problem, and a lot of companies, they really don't like to be clear about this. And even Dropbox went around in circles for a long time.
Doesn't that slow down speed if they have to encrypt it?
No, because that's the thing, is that 15, maybe even 10 years ago, that was definitely the case, is that there was a significant overhead to doing encryption. And as has been kind of addressed in the recent pushes to make more and more sites SSL encrypted, so that your connection to whatever service you are reaching is encrypted, then no one can get between you and where you're going, and play man in the middle kind of games. Google actually published a paper on, what properly tuned, how much performance does SSL drop, and it was like on the order of 1%. Which is nothing from the user experience. You're not going to notice if it's 1 second and 1 hundredth second or something.
Which begs the next question, though: how many of them are properly tuned?
Well, once that's done, that comes just down to scaling competencies. So yeah, if this is something you have to look for, if you're dealing with some sort of mom and pop outfit, they can say they've got 256 AES military grade encryption, blah, blah, blah. But if it's not implemented correctly, it doesn't matter. It's like, if you encrypt this block and then you send the user the key in the clear, then it doesn't matter that's encrypted because, and this is not a facetious example. There was actually a service that was, it was sending in the clear the AES key with the encrypted transmission. And it was like, this was a sign of someone who was trying to bolt on security, but didn't really understand it. Mm-hmm. And another principle that often is raised is security is really something that you have to build in from the ground up.
That's right.
It's you bolt it on after and you will have already created some problems. Just statistically, it's almost certain that you've created some problems that cannot be resolved by bolting something on afterwards.
Isn't that what happened to Microsoft Windows?
That was interesting. So their priority was backwards compatibility and usability. And so they would default all the safeties off. You know, they'd have all these features like initially, and this seems impossible to believe now, they came out with a firewall and they had it off by default until Service Pack 3 on XP, I believe. And, you know, here was the most basic thing. When they changed that default from off to on, the security threat level of the net environment overall made the most steep reduction in security threats in the history of computing. Hmm. That was amazing change because it was installed everywhere and all these worms and viruses were based on the idea that, you know, these ports would be open probably, and they were right because not enough people thought to turn them on to make a difference. So pre-internet encryption, something to look for. It has a friend, Trust No One, TNO. And that is, you know, is this implementation Trust No One? Am I relying on this party or a third party to manage some critical part? Like if I'm, you know, if I have to call you up on the phone in order to give you a key, I'm trusting the phone company. You know, as if I'm using public key cryptography, then at no point in between can someone intercept that key and get anything useful out of it. So almost all give up security for convenience and sometimes just a lack of imagination. The things that can be done with proper cryptography are pretty amazing. And there was a book on, what was it? It was the Bruce Schneier, I believe, did the sort of the definitive book on encryption. And it just went through the math of how these different schemes worked and what was possible. And one example was how to play a fair game of poker over the phone. It would be very, you know, of course, cumbersome because you're doing all these mathematic equations. But it was just saying, in principle, you can verify that someone has the cards they say they do without ever having known before that what their cards were.
Okay.
You know, so they could, you had enough information out there that they couldn't later change their story about what their cards were, the ones that they hadn't shown yet. So there was that. And
so I have a question about encryption.
Yeah.
You know, supposedly, and this is the way that it's supposed to work, but if you're using a cloud-based system, the information should be encrypted that's being stored, you know, in the cloud.
Well, hopefully. And a lot of people weren't doing this.
Right. Right, but even so, and this ties into, you know, as a community radio station, we're fiercely independent. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of fiercely independent personalities, and
yep.
Oftentimes we've got a lot of conspiracy theorists as well. You know, but we always have to look at both sides of the argument, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, we talked a little bit about this last week with regard to an event that happened with an ebook where it was illegally distributed. A lot of people bought it without knowledge of this, and then the company retracted it in a way which, if it were ever done physically, would be illegal. It would have been equivalent to a police officer walking into your office, taking it off the bookshelf and walking away with it. And in reality, they would have needed a warrant in order to do so.
Yes. They built in a piece of the reader that allowed them to remotely turn off bits and turn off delete books.
Right. So there's a concern with a lot of really smart people that were moving towards, you know, this kind of police state, this surveillance society, and that's part of the whole conspiracy theory stuff.
Yeah.
But it's important to take a look at it because society really is changing. And when it comes down to information that people are freely putting on the internet, be it Facebook or whatever, that other services can mine for information. Now, I'm not opposed to mining for information. What I'm opposed to is when information is taken out of context and intentionally distorted to create an inaccurate picture of reality.
Yeah, selective sampling. That's right.
And it's done all the time. Look at politicians. They do it all day long.
Yep.
They only cut a particular piece of, you know, somebody's statement, and they completely distort it to create, you know, their own point of argument.
Yeah, they'll take out micro portions of clips and say, imply that the person was saying something that later in that same sentence became very clear that they were not saying.
Right. So they don't have all the context.
Yeah.
So with regard...
Context elimination, yes. That's the wider problem with overzealous data collection.
Right.
They can make you look like a bad guy or a good guy by picking out what pieces to take.
Right. So in my opinion, there's something different about somebody doing something that's potentially criminal. And in a court of law, getting a warrant to enter the person's home, confiscate their computer equipment, and then put it in a forensics lab and recover whatever information there. In my opinion, that's different than somebody putting, well, let me clarify. My concern is that if something were simply out on the internet, in the cloud, even if it were encrypted, my understanding is that the government does not allow an encryption past what the government, you know, already has to read stuff. So is it possible then for the government to then mine this data using, you know, what's permissible encryption and then unencrypting it for the sake of surveillance? Is that feasible?
Well, actually, there was a time that before PGP, which stood for Pretty Good Privacy, and Phil Zimmerman, I believe, was the person who made that, and he really made this a personal cause to get encryption out to the masses. He came up with this product and gave it away, and you know, it later turned into a company and he sold it. But at the time where he was first engaged in this, using cryptography above a certain key strength was considered to be under the same regulations as shipping munitions.
That's right.
So you could only have, if your product, and this was horrible on software, if your product was available overseas, then you had to limit it to like 40-bit encryption or something, I think it was. Meanwhile, the equivalent tech companies in other countries who are perfectly capable of coming up with a properly implemented cryptography scheme and just using a longer key length, they would have the strong stuff, and their stuff would come into the country no problem. And so we were pretty much handing the software market to the competitors overseas. And people did things like they wrote the code for the cryptography algorithm on a T-shirt, and then underneath it said, this shirt is a illegal munition under code blah, 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 blah. You know, and they just made them look stupid. They did the same thing. They put them in books, and there was very strong constitutional protection against prior restraint on books.
So as a result of that, has the policy changed?
It's been lifted.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So there is no limit on what's allowed, and that is why these I think that may be an element to why somehow strong cryptography and proper implementations have not been as widespread. Now, I think the other thing is kind of the assumption for most people that haven't worked with cryptography, and I would, for the most part, include myself amongst them because I've studied it only from the outside, but they just make assumptions about how much processing time it will take to properly implement. And in reality, it's pretty trivial with today's processors. We have much more, the bottleneck at this point is the bandwidth of the connection, that establishing an interactive internet connection with the slow ramp-up speeding process, much more of a bottleneck than actually applying the encryption. And they use the really good public key stuff. It allows you to send some amount of data without actually you get a pair of keys that anything encrypted with key A can only be decrypted with key B. It can't even be decrypted with A. It is the process using that key is a one-way process, and only key B can properly decrypt it, and vice versa. They're really equivalent mathematically, but they just arbitrarily say one is the public key, which I will give to anyone, and one is the private key, which I will keep a secret. And then anyone in the world who sees my public key can encrypt using it and send a message that only I can read. They then sign it by encrypting their signature line with their private key. And when that is decrypted with their public key, you know that only they could have written it because only they had the secret key that matched with the public key. So between those, you have the basis of really good authentication and security. That part is very slow. The math on that is very slow. And so they generally use that just to send the key of the more traditional cipher where you need the same code. You run it through once and it encrypts it, and you run it through again and it decrypts it.
Okay.
And that's the huge one. So I think we're at that point where we need to throw in another
We
note.
Do indeed.
We so,
do
we,
indeed.
Yeah, we need to show appreciation for our fellow volunteers at the station that made it possible for us to have this show and have this conversation. So let's go to the next piece of explanation of what we're about.
Great radio isn't free, but through the effort of KMUZ Community Radio volunteers, it is very affordable. Periodically, we pass the virtual hat to gather money to pay for the things that volunteer labor just won't buy. Now is the time to remember what KMUZ has come to mean to you in just our first few months on the air and to toss something in that hat. Do your part to help keep KMUZ Radio coming to your hometown. Call us now, 503-990-6101. Again, you can reach us at 503-990-6101. And Duncan, if they are willing to make a donation, what can they obtain?
Well, in addition to the base thing is this is making radio possible. So the real thing that you're getting is you get to have a continued presence of a community radio station. And I know that that is something that has not been easy to come by in Salem. For some reason, the elements haven't been quite right for a long time. But, of course, the first thing, anyone who is donating, we want to show our appreciation and allow you to kind of show your support for the station by giving you one of the bumper stickers. And that's the more – it would be lovely to see a bunch of those out there. I'd love to be driving around town and see a lot of KMUZ bumper stickers.
A lavish bumper sticker.
Lavishly crafted bumper stickers, yes. Now, when you get home, because you wouldn't want to do this by driving, while driving, you will be able to have a refreshing beverage for contributions of $40 or more. In addition to the bumper sticker and having community radio at all, you will also get a cup. And this cup, how do you describe this cup?
This cup is lavishly decorated.
Yes, lavishly decorated with the KMUZ logo and traditional fighting colors, as it were. But beyond that, I know this is the capital city, and I know that the business community in Salem has been very strong, and they have been showing, I think as of late, lots of good support for community and arts and things like radio. But anyone who says, you know, I really want, I can't necessarily come down there and be a full-time volunteer or a part-time volunteer or have a radio show, but I do appreciate this, you know, and I'm willing to throw in $100 or more into that pot to, you know, keep the transmitter going, keep all the hardware going that matches the effort that other people are putting out there and making this possible. And when you pass the $100 mark, which you have our eternal gratitude for, amazed reception for it, you also get something to put in that coffee cup. And that is going to be a gift certificate from one of our great friends over at Clockworks Cafe and Cultural Center. And they have been one of the places lately that has really been pushing forward and trying to bring more multicultural and entertainment and community to Salem. You know, been letting us use their meeting rooms and such. It's been a great place to – it really helped the right people find each other to keep things going. So for $100 or more, in addition to the bumper sticker and the cup, you know, please, please accept a $10 gift certificate and, you know, go hang out at a really one of the hubs of vibrant energy in Salem. So with that, and you know, I think that is our last pledge break for this show. So I just again want to say that phone number, 503-990-6101. Please give us a call. My clone Duncan number 30 will be answering and taking your pledges, and I thank you in advance for that. So I actually one of the unexpected benefits of having a stop for pledge break is it like kind of gets a chance to recover from that rolling down the hill train out of control momentum that sometimes builds on one of those serial rants there. So
the movie Train Wreck?
Not wreck, you know. I'm saying it's kicking in the brakes. You know, it's someone pulling the cord and say, wait a minute.
Sure.
Pledge, we don't need to plunge over the cliff right now. We could take a pledge break first.
That's right. What do you know about Tor?
Tor, the onion router.
Yes.
That has been, that was initially a free software. It was an independent open source software initiative, which has been taken over by the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which in itself, I it's hard for me to express how silly that name sounded to me when they first formed. Because, I mean, we had like, I think that was in the era of, you know, we had Apple IIs and we were doing spreadsheets and stuff. And there we had a few things like the well.
That tied into Richard Stallman out at...
Free Software Foundation is, yeah. Richard Stallman, yeah. Was he at the well? Is that what you're saying?
Well, the Free Software Foundation just rung a bell, and for some reason I remember Richard Stallman.
He came up with the GNU in GNU Linux,
right?
And that's the way only way he'll accept is the proper name for that, because he was part of an early computing movement where they really believed in the openness of computers, and you know they were like doing things in the MIT lab, like refusing to set passwords. And then when they did set a password, they all set the same password because they didn't even believe people should have individual logins.
He was a really interesting character. And it's hard for me to determine if he's a visionary or if he has a mental disorder.
Yes. Yeah, I think sometimes it's both, you know. Yeah. But to get back to the onion router, the idea here is you want to be able to conceal the actual destination you're going to. Now, a traditional web connection with SSL on it, you will have an encrypted connection to Google or whatever it is you're accessing, you know, Google Mail, for example, maybe. And theoretically, no one should be able to break into that. But your ISP and anyone operating any element of the internet through which your traffic passes through, they will see in each packet, this is the IP address that this traffic is coming from. This is the IP address that it's going to. IP addresses for home connections don't change very much. So it's pretty much, it's almost like a phone number pointing right back at you. It's like, okay, at this time, from this time to this time, Nate was at home talking to Google, you know, or whatever it was, or name your whatever disreputable site someone wants to embarrass you with or something like that. Maybe you don't want to have it might for like protesters in oppressive regimes. You know, they want to be able to reach blogs that talk about their issues without anyone knowing who it is that's visiting that site. So the idea with the onion router is each package is wrapped in different layers of encryption, like the layers of an onion. And there is a network of onion relay points. You know, people just voluntarily run this as another service. Instead of running a web service, they're running an onion rerouter service, which basically allows it to be a intentionally selected element of a path going to your ultimate destination across the net. Normally, you just pick the shortest path, but with the onion router, you're going through three specially selected sites within that network. You have a list of all the sites that are participating. You pick three at random. Each of them has a public and private key. And what you do is you say, okay, I'm going to enter the onion here, the onion network here. This other one is, this point B is going to be my second stop within the onion network. And then I will go to point C, a third point in the onion network. And then from there, I will go to my ultimate destination. Now, I should point out at this point that each of these sites within the onion network can be run by completely different people with no legal or political connections. And they could even be a nefarious site that is trying to be malicious. But they all said, okay, I'm following the onion protocol. Here's my public key. So you say, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this packet that's going to Google, and I'm going to encrypt it so that only point C in the onion network can read it. Then I'm going to take that message and I'm going to wrap that message and the fact that I'm going through point C, and I'm going to encrypt it in another layer of encryption that only node B can read. Then I'm going to take that and add another layer of encryption that only point A can read. Then I fire the message off to point A. Okay, so anyone who's watching my connection, all they can see is that I have made a connection. Anyone who can see my segment of the net that I'm on, anywhere between me and the onion network, they can see that I'm sending a packet off to A, but they can't tell what's in it because everything below that's encrypted. Mm. A takes off the first wrapper. Now it can see another encrypted blob plus the fact that it's supposed to go, that its next stop should be B. So it knows now, if you assume that point A is corrupted, now they could just say, I'm going to throw this packet away and we're not actually going to act as an onion router, in which case this whole point is moot. You know, it's like you just have a dead connection, you try another route. Okay, but assume they're playing along and they're trying to be nefarious. Well, all they can see is that David made a connection somewhere using the onion network, because all they have is my address and an encrypted blob, and that B was involved. But B is not necessarily run by them. So if you assume that they're not working together, that doesn't really tell them much. Now they send it on to B. B decrypts it. They now have another encrypted blob that they can't read, plus that the fact that it's going to C. And they know just from the connection that it came from A, but they don't know who it ultimately came from, because that's part of the information that A threw away when it forwarded the inner blob. Now C gets it. It unwraps the last layer of encryption, and now it makes a connection to the ultimate destination and delivers that content. And all replies from Google or whatever do exactly the same thing. Google doesn't have to know about the onion network. All it knows is it thinks as far as Google's concerned, C is a proxy for you. Whatever you're doing, Google sees it as coming from point C, and all its replies are automatically rewrapped with B's encryption and sent back.
So is there very much latency with this?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So you got the latency because it's making multiple hops. The other thing you have is because of the limited number of nodes, the speed of any connection is based on the slowest point between yourself and where you're ultimately going to. And when you're going through an onion network, you're essentially concentrating the traffic. All the traffic on Earth that wants to go through the onion network is going through a limited number of nodes. So below a certain number, you're going to have a speed problem. That's why they really say, please, 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 please don't do BitTorrent across Tor, because you're going to kill it.
Okay. So the trade-off is that you get anonymity, but you also get
low performance. Yeah. Your ability to do things like, doing YouTube videos or something would be pretty or I should say Skype, the latency speed king. Skype would be pretty much impossible across Tor. That's my assumption. I haven't tried it. It'd be an interesting experiment.
Okay.
All right. Well, you've just spent another engrossing hour listening to Northwest Tech Show. I believe that sort of wraps up our time this week. Nate, thank you so much for joining me.
It's a pleasure.
And, fighting back a little bit. It's awesome. So we'll come to you in some configuration or other every Wednesday at noon. So come on back and listen to Northwest Tech Show. Thanks.